KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, libraries are going through major sea changes with more doubtless to come. And in the hour ahead, we look at the future of libraries and discuss ways in which they've changed and are likely to continue to change. A panel joins us and we'll take your calls and emails next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Radical changes have been occurring in libraries with the advent of the Internet and new technology, and California's public libraries are certainly diverse, though most have a wide demographic appeal and are seeing demand and circulation rising. Each serves a unique clientele, from the fewer than 1,300 people in Alpine County to the population of over 4 million in the city of Los Angeles. This hour of Forum, we want to turn our attention to the status of libraries and discuss their future. And joining us, Martin Gomez, who's president of the Urban Libraries Council, with us this morning from Chicago. Welcome, Martin Gomez.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Jim Rettig, who's joining us from Richmond, Virginia. He's president of the American Library Association. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Glad to have you as well. And here with us in studio, we've got these two national voices with us and two local voices. In fact, the South Bay is well represented here this morning. Jane Light is director of the San Jose Library. They're going to have their fifth kickoff anniversary on the 6th of September. Jane Light, welcome.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. And Alice Scoffier is also with us. And October 19th marks the 100th anniversary of the Burlingame Public Library, where he is city librarian. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
Glad to have you all aboard. And Martin Gomez, I'm going to begin with you. Certainly a lot of talk about the Internet and its importance. I guess the real question is, at this point, it's changed the whole nature of libraries, and maybe too early to say whether there are more pluses and minuses.
Well, I think overall, if you look at the evolution of the public library over the last 100-plus years, we've been very flexible and adaptable. I think that's one of the things that's enabled us to become, heavily used over time. What's, I think, even more significant now is that what we've found is that the technology is actually driving more traffic to our libraries. So, yes, it's a challenge, but I think that we've got some smart people working in libraries across the country, and we've figured out how to carve out new roles for the public library in the age of technology.
Certainly a new role for the reference librarians.
A little different role, that's right.
But the sense is that the nature of libraries is changing. It's having more of a central role overall in the communities. It's bringing in populations that didn't come in before, demographics, I mean immigrants, for example, and it's even becoming an after-school place. In other words, just what libraries were is not necessarily what libraries are now.
Well, I think we've evolved certainly from this idea of a space for materials and collections to an institution that really has, I think, done a really good job of defining its social purpose, and you alluded to a couple of those. I think overall one of our pluses is that because we're perceived as a very neutral place, we have the opportunity to serve all kinds of people in a variety of ways. So I think that we've done a good job over the last 40, 50 years in adapting.
Can I get you to talk a little bit about that neutrality that you just alluded to? There was a study I know just completed called Welcome Stranger and talks about the importance of, well, the library being a neutral institution.
Yeah, the Urban Libraries Council commissioned a report that we published last January called Welcome Stranger. And what it tries to chronicle for not only our library audience, but also people who are in policymaking positions, is the important value of libraries in helping immigrants and refugees who are settling in many of our cities to transition into American society. We looked at the ways that libraries are really being very sensitive culturally, and this is something, again, we've done for decades by having bilingual collections, staffing, a variety of cultural programming, supporting English language classes in our libraries, maybe not done by the librarians, but bringing in professionals who are what they call ESL teachers, and then functioning as a broker, if you will, in the neighborhoods to make sure that immigrants and new, even newcomers, perhaps not even immigrants, but just people who are settling in a neighborhood, understand the wealth of resources that might be available to them. So functioning as a broker between the library and other local institutions.
So what do you see as major obstacles up ahead?
Well, I think funding has always been a challenge for us, and there was another report out recently by an organization called OCLC, the Online Computer Library Center, which is called From Awareness to Funding. And I think one of the big challenges is that for libraries, many people don't understand how they're funded or how they're governed. So unless people really, you know, kind of dig down a little deeper, they would realize, they have not realized yet, I should say, that libraries are still struggling to basically make ends meet.
Martin Gomez is president of the Urban Libraries Council. He's with us this morning from Chicago. With us from Richmond, Virginia, is Jim Reddick, who is president of the American Library Association. And Jim Reddick, we had a story on NPR about Google's digitizing five of the major libraries in the United States, and I was reading yesterday all about the impact of Web 2.0. It's pretty substantial when you think about blogs and social networks and wikis and all that, tagging and so forth. Can you future-proof a library?
I think that we are continuously future-proofing our libraries, and we take advantage of new technologies as they come along. The Web 2.0 movement has given us opportunities to make our users partners, and they get to contribute their comments on books that are listed in our catalogs. That helps other readers make selections. They can make recommendations that other readers might want to follow. Young adult services librarians have used these things very effectively because their clientele tends to live and communicate through those 2.0 technologies. They use Facebook rather than email to communicate with their friends, for example.
The whole role, though, seems to be changing again of libraries in the sense that with all of this new technology, you have a lot more people coming in the library, and it's almost like they're looking for information about caseworkers or about the IRS or just about government services and resources. It's playing a prominent role, isn't it, all that?
There's been a lot of movement by the government to put services on the web. And in fact, some local and county governments will require job applications to be submitted on the web. These things can be confusing, and they get help from the librarians in using the technology and understanding what they need to do to obtain these services.
It's important for the library also to let the population know, particularly the population that needs it, these services are available. I mean, there's a marketing component here that's quite important, isn't it?
Yes, and that's nothing new. We've always had an important marketing responsibility to make sure that people know what services and resources we offer that can be meaningful in their lives.
Let's talk about some of those with you. For example, there are a lot of things that are available in the library, scholarly journals, for example, that are not available on the free web.
That's true, and that's one of the things that I think a lot of people fail to appreciate about the difference between the web and what the library offers. For example, here in Virginia, our state library licenses a number of databases that are very useful to high school students, middle school students, and businesses. Anybody who has a public library card from a Virginia library has access to those 24/7, and we continually are trying to get people to recognize this is there, right there on their desktop at all times.
You got a lot more video editing available on computers now, too.
Yes, indeed. And I think that we will see an accelerating trend where instead of doing the term paper with all the bibliography apparatus, students will be doing multimedia projects to present new interpretations of information, and even more advanced students presenting new knowledge that way.
Can you talk a little bit about the gaming side of this, which is more, I suppose, beyond I don't see much of that going on in the libraries I go to, so tell me about this, or inform me more, if you would.
Well, there's a good deal of it in the high school libraries, as well as some public libraries, and this relates in part to the marketing issue. teenagers may not think of the library as the cool place to go and to be able to do things. Gaming nights, gaming tournaments, these sorts of things attract them. And once they get there, the librarians have the opportunity to show these kids that there's lots more to the library than just playing games. Gaming has some very positive benefits, just like complex board games like chess. They have to learn a complex set of rules. They have to learn to collaborate with others. Some of these are multiplayer games. They have to learn problem solving to get to one level and then to the next level of a game. So these are skills and talents that they'll need all their lives.
And Jim Rettig is president of the American Library Association and is with us from Richmond, Virginia. We've got a couple of local library directors with us, actually a director of San Jose Library, Jane Light, and the city librarian of the Burlingame Public Library, Alice Goffier. And Jane Light, let me go to you first here and let's get a sense of just what's going on at the San Jose Library. I saw a lot of activity there. I was a keynote there recently, and I was amazed at the resources and the activities that were going on, and quite impressed, I must tell you. In these bad economic times that we're in, it seems to be even more busy, doesn't it?
It does seem to be busy. In fact, in our system, I just saw the statistics that compared checkouts of July a year ago and July this year, and we had 7% more than we'd had a year ago. That was, we had predicted it, because every time the economy gets bad, people start coming to their library, using those free resources, not checking out our videos instead of renting a video. Our summer reading club, we had 26,000 people participating in summer reading this summer. We are a city of 1 million people, but that's a pretty good penetration. And again, that was up. Kids are staying home more this summer, maybe not going away to camp, but doing day camps.
How does that 26,000 compare to the past?
Well, we are usually between 20 and 22,000, so we're up substantially. And some of that is our outreach to the schools, but a lot of it we know was families knowing they were going to be home all summer and they'd plan to come every week.
You're seeing these same kind of jumps over in Burlingame, Alice Goffier?
Yes, we are. This has been our highest year ever for the summer reading clubs. We did add an adult component this year, which brought in more adults. Our statistics are very similar to Jane's, about 7% year over year the last couple of years. We had a whopping 19% increase in this July over July 07, and we attribute that to the reading clubs for all ages.
So times are good in that sense for libraries, but on the other hand, of course, we keep hearing all this heralding about the death of books and poor Nicholson Baker, bringing a lawsuit because they're destroying thousands of books for computer space. I mean, that's kind of emblematic in many ways of the shift that we've seen take place. Can I get either of you to comment on that?
Well, I think it's a delicate balance. I think you have you need the printed word. We see parents bringing their children in for story hours. We do 7 story hours a week, 100 kids at each session. Parents really want to motivate their kids to read, and the printed word is very important. And the printed word is part of knowledge. Technology is another aspect of information.
But Jane Light, there's more warehousing of books now, or in fact in the San Francisco Public Library they destroyed a couple hundred thousand books.
Well, in our system actually we think of our branch libraries as sort of beautiful warehouses, and so that anyone can go online, request a book, it be sent to the branch that's most convenient for them, we will pull that item and ship it to them. So we've kind of looked at our system as one big warehouse, but in terms of the materials. But what they aren't anymore is book warehouses. And I think one of the most interesting things in the last decade is the amount of library building, public libraries in California, and how there's no new buildings, of which the King Library you mentioned is one in San Jose, but we're basically rebuilding our entire branch system with 20 teardowns or rebuilds of libraries, that those libraries are 2.5-3 times the size of the old libraries. They have a lot of books and materials in them. But they also have many computers. They have community rooms. Our libraries have internet cafes in them, so that there are can finally play that role of sort of the community's gathering place to learn individually or collectively about matters of interest. So we have English as a second language conversation classes, citizenship classes, parenting experts to come and talk, a real variety of activities.
All which come under the aegis of more of a community center in many respects.
It is. I think it's the new role of reference librarians. Instead of answering questions one-on-one, we're learning what our community is struggling with. It may be childhood obesity. It may be diabetes in the Latino community. And bringing some resources to bear, both print materials, but our community experts, to present information to the community. It's a whole new role. Before, we were kind of tied to our desks with those demands to answer those one-on-one questions. Now we're more free to really step back and say, what's the whole community interested in, and how can we find partners to answer those needs?
That pretty much conforms to what we're seeing over in your shop, Alco Escobia?
Yes, definitely. I think the library's place is becoming more important. People come to us for a variety of reasons to actually use the facilities. It's also a cultural outlet for people. We sponsor a number of programs now that we didn't sponsor in the past. Our One Book, One Community program, we're now in our third year in Peninsula Library System, and we get literally tens of thousands of people reading the books, coming to programs across the county. It's usually on a subject that's of great importance, that something people should know about. This year we're doing What is the What?, Dave Eggers' book about the Sudanese Lost Boys.
And yeah, I'm involved in that too.
Yes, you are. We appreciate that.
But there's also a sense that these are lean times and budget shortfalls and all of those kinds of things. You have the San Mateo Public Library, for example, which became a model, three times the size of the old Main, $65 million, which is mainly bond money and grants and charitable donations. I know there's been shrinking budgets for the last 6 years over there in San Jose, and yet the building looks brand spanking new and really pretty impressive, as I said.
The buildings are great.
We had good capital campaigns.
We had some good capital campaigns for the King Library and good ones for the branches. The ongoing operations really are the big issue for us and many other libraries. Our city, as a city, we're part of the municipal government, is really struggling. We are in our sixth, soon to be seventh, year of budget cuts. And I've been working with some of my colleagues in the city to look at what that future is going to look like. And it's not looking so great at the moment. So there's several dilemmas. One is, how do people understand what a great bargain libraries are? In San Jose...
There's your marketing again.
Yeah, we spend about $34 per capita in San Jose for library services. There aren't a whole lot of government services that can offer so much for that kind of money. But there's that, and there's competition, and there's with other departments, public safety particularly. And then there's finally, I'd say, really dysfunctional government financing in the state of California. And we're in California in worse shape than most other states seem to be.
Not only in worse shape, but I was looking at some statistics. There are only 50 states, but California is 51st. I guess that includes Guam and Puerto Rico in the ratio of students, library media teachers per student, and also the relationship in K-12 per student number of books. I don't know, maybe get Martine Gomez or Jim Reddick to comment on that. Why, perhaps, or what California can do? You see the whole picture nationally.
Well, nationally, this is Martine, Michael. I think that there is a sad trend here in that, and California, in this case, happens to be the leader, where there is not enough support for school libraries across the nation. And as a result, the public libraries, by default, are becoming kind of that resource that I had when I was growing up, going to elementary to middle school, where you have a trained professional able to help you learn how to use the library resources and suggest good reading and support the curriculum of the school. Nowadays, it's defaulting to the library, the public library, and that's a sad state. And part of it has to do, I think, with kind of this whole notion of what is the value of the library, either in the school setting or in the public library setting. And the more that the librarian can work to demonstrate that the return on investment, if you will, is not just an immediate, not only an immediate, but also a long-term investment for the value of community services. 80% of public libraries, or 80% of the funding for public libraries, is local money, and yet people don't necessarily understand how that money is raised or where it comes from. So it's an interesting dilemma for us.
Jim Rennan, can I get you to comment on this?
I'd be happy to. 2 points. One is the insidious flip side of this increased use in public libraries is increased pressure on school system budgets. And there have been recent reports in scattered states of plans to get rid of the professionals in the school libraries to cope with the budgets.
They're depending more and more on volunteers, I imagine, aren't they?
Some places are doing that. Other places are turning them into clerical positions, which don't have the knowledge, experience, and education to do what the librarian can do. There's also, the second point is, there's an ample body of research that shows a strong, strong relationship between the presence in a school of a well-funded school library that is operated by a certified school library media specialist, correlation between that and student achievement. So when a school system decides to eliminate those librarian positions, what they're doing is leaving their children behind. And the No Child Left Behind Act actually has a role in this, in that it specifies certain categories of personnel that a school must have, and the librarians are not included in that category, so that makes them easy pickings when it comes time to cut budgets.
Well, it brings up another question for our two guests here in studio, Jane Light and Alice Scoffier. When it comes time to cutting, what gets cut first, or what gets cut last?
Well, libraries are primarily made up of people, staff, and collection, and that translates into hours, and that's what has to be cut. We generally start with hours first.
Jane Light, same?
I'd say over time, we started a little cuts around the margin. We stopped our bookmobile service. We just had one bookmobile. We cut 1 hour of service 3 days a week, and then we moved 1 hour up and opened at 11 and closed at 8, thereby saving 1 hour of night shift differential. We did a lot of those little things in the first few years.
Then, but you didn't cut web access.
We didn't cut web access. I've never cut an information technician from my staff during this time, because people's ability to serve themselves is what one of the things I have to provide if I'm going to keep my doors open. So we need to keep that web access happening. Now, as times have continued to go, we ended up cutting half of Mondays a couple of years ago, and this year, 6 out of 7 of our branch libraries are open. Our Sundays are no longer open on Sundays. So every year, it's getting to be more dramatic.
It's thinner.
There's nothing left to around the edges anymore, and we're down to thinking maybe a 5-day week service. Which
in L.A., I think it was a library in L.A. where they had a collection plate, I remember, out in front of the library, but it hasn't descended to that level yet. But there's also the sense that libraries are becoming a place of refuge. Certainly for kids, they're safe places. Many parents who don't have childcare will leave their kids in the library. But also, I remember a big case back in New Jersey, I think it was, where there was a homeless guy who was in a library, and they kicked him out because he smelled so badly. You got all these kinds of new phenomena with respect to being more of a community outreach institution. Well, let's talk about this with you, our listeners. Many of you use the public libraries, and many of you certainly know libraries in the schools that you're at, so you might want to comment on just how valuable the libraries are to you and what kind of concerns you have about the future as libraries are changing in their whole identity and taking on a whole different sense of nuances where identity is concerned. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. That'll work whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to forum@kqed.org. As we continue with Martine Gomez, Jim Rettig, Alice Scoffier, and Jane Light, this is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour about libraries, a valuable, I would say an invaluable community resource. How do you use them, and what do you find particularly in this resource that affects your lives? We're talking about that. We're also talking about the change in traditional libraries, which are caught between declining budgets and the explosive growth of online research, and talking with a couple of experts in the field. They're all experts in the field. A couple of people who are on the national scene, Martine Gomez, who is president of the Urban Libraries Council, and Jim Rettig, who is president of the American Library Association, with us respectively from Chicago and Richmond, Virginia. And here in studio, Alice Scoffier, who is city librarian for the Burlingame Public Library, and Jane Light, who's director of the San Jose Library. And let's go to your calls, and we're going to begin with Anne in San Mateo. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning. I was wondering, we have all these wonderful new library buildings, but the hours have been cut so much. About corporate sponsorship to fund opening hours, like this hour has been, the hour from 9 to 10 has been sponsored by Genentech or something like that.
What about that, Al? You want to be?
Well, it's a great idea. It's hard to get the corporations to give sometimes, but we've been fortunate. We have a library foundation which has been in operation for the last 14 years, and they help us with collection. They have helped with hours in the past. But yes, that is a very good way. Private money is a very good way to help public libraries.
Are we seeing any kind of a trend here, do you think, Jim Reddick? You know, the Pepsi reading room, or, I mean, there's a Pepsi convention hall now in Denver where the Democrats are. But
It tends to happen in new building construction that they're naming opportunities for reading rooms or the computer lab. Unfortunately, the follow-through after that is rarely there.
We'll go to more calls, and John, join us. Good morning.
Yes, my question is about the building as opposed to the infrastructure and the number of books in the library. I wonder if this is well balanced or not, because it seems to me like I'd rather have another book than a nice building, just personally.
You want to talk about that, Martine Gomez?
I'm not sure if I can, Michael, or perhaps one of my partners there, colleagues, could speak to that, because I'm not operating in a library these days. I think there's always going to be trade-offs, but perhaps one of the others might answer that.
Jane Light, can you respond?
Well, when I first came to San Jose in 1997, we took a good hard look at our branch library system and realized our average branch library was serving 50,000 people in 7,000 square feet. We had 10 computers and 40 seats. We had crammed them full of materials, but they were now kind of takeout libraries, because where was there a place for you to sit and study or learn? We didn't have community rooms. So we identified that in our case, our 30 to 40-year-old buildings needed to be expanded, or really we could not play a full role for a library. We then went to the voters and got 76% of them to agree with us to pass a bond. So I think that there's a certain point at which buildings have outlived their usefulness, or the community has grown so much, you just have to have a bigger building.
Can I have a follow-up on that?
Jim Reddick. Oh, I'm sorry. This is a caller. I thought it was Jim. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. If you had more hours, you could do more with the same building space, couldn't you?
To a small degree, yes, but there's only 10 computers, and your after-school and Saturday hours are your busiest hours. They're not going to be able to meet the need, or you cannot have a story time for the 100 children that come because you can only seat 20 kids.
Let me thank you, John, for the call. And I want to go to a caller named Renee. Good morning. You're joining us on forum. Hi.
Good morning. My comment was just that I used to work in a library, and we used to get homeless people in there all of the time. And, gosh, sometimes it was bearable, sometimes it wasn't. But when it wasn't, we would kick them out. And it's kind of sad, but at the same time, it's like disturbs everybody else. And I don't even know what to say about it, because it's like, I mean, it happens, so... Gosh. Okay.
I thank you for the comment. Well, Martine Gomez, you're the urban library guy. This is a problem, isn't it?
Well, it's not a problem as much as it is, I guess, a challenge in that many libraries, not just with homeless populations, but any community that might come in where there is a concern, let's say unruly teens or unruly kids after school, a couple things. One is good libraries have good policies that help them manage those issues. And more often than not, what they're doing is working with local community agencies to help if somebody's homeless, they need health services or cleaning services, bodily cleaning services, that they can refer folks or have the caseworkers come in and work with them locally. And because we're an open community resource, it's pretty hard for us to kind of shut the doors on folks until the rules of conduct and behavior are well understood and well spelled out for people.
Let me thank the caller and move on to more of your calls. And by the way, the number to call here if you'd like to join the program, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to forum@kqed.org. Sean, good morning.
Good morning. I just had a couple of comments about our library system here in Roseville. We use a lot of volunteers, for instance, the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, who need to do service projects to progress through the programs, do a lot of service hours in our library, stocking books and reshelving them and things. But I also was curious what your guests' opinion were or how much they know about the scandal that's going on with the Sacramento County Library with the misappropriation of funds and everything that's going on, and it's really decreased the usership of the library in Sacramento as well as the public opinion of the library.
Anybody know what's going on in Sacramento? No? I'm sorry, we can't get any light shone on that, but maybe somebody else can call in or send an email. I thank you for the call. Talking about things going on in Sacramento and changes in library, Jane Light, was I reading right that over in Arizona, to our south here, and done away with the Dewey Decimal System?
Well, there was recently several articles that I read in the professional press about a branch library in Arizona that was a brand-new library, and they decided to place items on their shelves not in the Dewey Decimal System, which I admit
just alphabetized?
Just alphabetized, or by topic, and then alphabetized. It's the way a bookstore might. And I admit I have had to come to recognize that although to a librarian, a Dewey Decimal System that's, you know, based on 100 numbers ought to be pretty simple, it is, in fact, not only a mystery, but an intimidating mystery to far too many of our users. My library has not gone as far as that Arizona library, but, you know, we have in our libraries what we call a marketplace, where all the new materials are arranged similarly to that of a bookstore by topic or by media type, and then alphabetically within that, so people can come and find the latest we have in cookbooks or mystery books or home repair. And those, I would say, easily 25% of the total circulation comes from those areas, both because they're hot and new, but also because they're a lot easier to use.
Well, in answer to the caller who brought up the Sacramento question, this is from the Sacramento Bee. Kevin just brought this in. It says the Sacramento Public Library's governing board approved a response to a critical grand jury report that essentially rejects most of the panel's findings. The report was issued in May after a six-month probe that found numerous shortcomings in management, excessive use of consultants, and various other problems inside the library. It included a recommendation that the board consider firing Library Director Anne-Marie Gold, whom actually I know because I went to college with her husband. That's getting you right up to date here. Before I go to more of your calls, here's some emails I wanted to get to. Here's a reference librarian who writes the following. So glad to see you addressing this topic, but I'm surprised to see only public libraries represented on your panel today. College and university libraries dramatically changed the way we offer our collections and services. Providing access to information, whether online or in print format, is only part of our job. A huge part of what we do is teach students research and information literacy skills. Many students think that if they can type a few words into Google, they know everything they need to know to complete their class assignments or find information for their own lives. Our job is to teach them to think about what kinds of information they need, how to structure search statements that help them best find that information, whether in our print collections or online sources, and then how to evaluate the information they find there to determine whether it's good and useful information. With the explosion of various online tools and sources of information, many of them absolutely wonderful, our job of helping students sort through all the stuff that's out there is more important than ever, and thank you for that. That's certainly true about the public libraries as well, though.
Could I comment on that?
Yeah, of course. Jim
Reddick. My entire career for the last 32 years has been in university libraries, and the email author has described the situation very, very well, and what you will find in most academic libraries is a real shift from the sitting and waiting for reference questions to a strong outreach effort within our communities, which is the students and the faculty to whom we serve, and working with the faculty to help them realize that these students may know technology well, but that doesn't know that they have these information literacy skills and abilities that they need to select information, analyze it, and synthesize it well. So we try to get into the classes with the faculty and work with the students one-on-one and in small groups and in instructional sessions. And that's part of the transformation of the academic library.
Well, here are some more emails. Let me read some that express opinions. This is from Daphne, who says, fortunately, technology and budget cuts cannot intrude upon the comfort and joy of sitting in a caregiver's lap and reading Goodnight Moon in the children's section of the library. Well said. Thank you for that. Here's Merrick, who writes, I love the new computer use of the library. I'm a voracious reader. Most books I get at the library by requesting them by computer, picking them up when I get the message they're there for me, and I can keep track of where I am on the list of books requested. It's a great system. Here's Kathleen, though, who raises a question that certainly needs to be considered in these lean times. She says, I live in Vallejo. I love the library. It's open much around here. They don't have a great collection, but I get things very quickly from surrounding libraries. I'm worried that the libraries will suffer because of Vallejo's bankruptcy. And, of course, this is an important point because there are cities that are facing such lean times. She writes, aside from writing to the mayor to show my support, what more can I do? I see a lot of kids in the libraries in the summer and after school. For a city with so many financial problems, we actually don't have many services. We need to keep the libraries open and accessible. Martin Gomez, have any sage words of advice here in terms of people who are in a situation like Kathleen?
Well, I think one of the things that happens in public libraries, and this is a good thing, is that for many neighborhoods, they have many neighborhood libraries have Friends of the Library organizations. These are the advocacy groups that perhaps the caller or email correspondent could work with their local friends groups to try to get the issue of library funding and library services more than just a letter to the mayor, but make it a community cause, if you will. I think that's one of the things, too, that's happened with school libraries and media centers is that it's very difficult for a lot of organization among the parents, for example, to help advocate on behalf of school library and media centers, although I did hear recently there was a group, I think, working out of Washington State that had been very successful in getting the legislature to change the funding priorities for school and media centers.
Well, here's let me go to a couple more emails. Here's a listener who says, I'm worried about digital restrictions, DRM. Can any of your guests comment?
well,
silence is deafening here. Yeah.
Limit what we can do with the resources Jim Reddick. And license.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said, Jim.
We're worried, too. Digital rights management systems limit what we can do with some of the resources that we'd like to offer our users. For example, the terms of use for the Kindle are officially that public libraries should not be using them and loaning them.
This is a listener with a question for you, Jane Light. Says, as your topic is how libraries are keeping up or dealing with change, including changing demographics, I have the following question for Jane Light. Why is there not a single person of color on the San Jose Public Library management team? Further, why is there only one Hispanic branch manager soon to retire, leaving zero in a city with over 300,000 Hispanics?
Well, our staff, we have had a number of great kind of groundbreaking Latino librarians who are of my generation, several of whom have retired. And we are now have hired a really exciting new crop of young librarians who in a few years will be ready to move into these great management positions as older folks begin to retire.
And they are people of color. I think that's addressing the concern that the listener has. Yeah.
We have... we're fortunate to have Vietnamese-speaking librarians, Chinese-speaking librarians, Spanish-speaking librarians, and we are also fortunate that several of our staff have been able to get some scholarship money to, in kind of, after some years of working in non-professional positions, to get a Master's of Library Science so that they can join the professional ranks.
And the management team?
We have a very small management team and presently of seven people. I think presently we don't have any ethnic minorities on it.
There's a note from my producer that says the most underrepresented group in terms of librarians may be men. Is that true, Alice Goffey?
Yes, I think that's true, and it's always been true. But I think we, as Jane has mentioned, we're looking for fresh faces on our staff at every level. It's really important that we get young people to get library education and to come into the profession. We really need their skills.
One of the issues that Martin may want to talk about, too, is that, frankly, very bright young Latino college students may not see the library field as the most lucrative or appealing profession. And so although 30% of San Jose's population are Latinos, it's around a much lower number, I think under 10% of the professional librarians nationally are. So trying to appeal to the whole community to think about library careers is kind of a challenge given the low pay and some of the wonderful rewards, but also the frustrations of budget cuts and other kinds of challenges.
You want to comment, Martin Gomez?
Yeah, Jane's right. You know, this is a national issue. There is only so much that we can supply in the pipeline, and the library schools, like the one in San Jose State and others, have done a tremendous job over the last few years to try to increase the diversity of its student population. We were fortunate in the last few years to sponsor something called the ULC Urban Libraries Council Scholarship Program that was aimed at increasing diversity in libraries throughout the nation, and we've had over 300 people go through that program sponsored by local libraries like San Jose Public. But there's such a demand. You know, one of these folks can get a degree and maybe start off in San Jose and get snatched up by Burlingame, for example, just because there is a need for
it. Is this like college football, or there a competition out there like that?
Except that the stakes, the finances are not as high. I don't think
you got library headhunters now.
No signing bonuses.
Let me get some more of our calls on. Valerie, join us. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to talk about your first comments about demand and circulation and address the situation in Palo Alto. We're very excited because we've seen our circulation increase by 45% in the last 7 years, and we have 2,300 visitors a day. And that's huge for our community. But at the same time, we find we're very humiliated because we have the worst and the most outdated facilities in the Bay Area. Our auditor reported a year ago that Palo Alto ranked dead last out of 10 peninsula libraries, which is just atrocious for a community such as ours.
Especially a community that houses the Stanford University.
The university, and we value education so much. So over a period of many years, we've had an intensive effort to design a system that's responsive to our youth and families. And something I haven't heard very much today, also our seniors. A city report said that by 2030, maybe a third of our population could be over 55 because we aren't moving. We're staying in this community. And the students and the seniors and the families demand collections and spaces that are more responsive to the way we live today, not the way we lived 50 years ago. So we've been designing a system. We've designed one that we believe is consistent with our city comprehensive plan. We value neighborhoods and walkable communities. And now we have a bond measure that'll go to the voters in November. It's Measure N. We believe it's a really strong investment, very consistent with what your speakers have talked to today, is an investment, again, in collections, well, in the space, how we use space and how we build our collections for the future. We've been very sensitive to the economy. The median home in Palo Alto, the median homeowner, would pay less than $139 a year. That's a few dollars a week. And our effort in the next few months will be helping people see what a benefit this investment will be for each individual family.
Well, as long as you're mentioning that particular bond measure, and thank you for
bringing
that up.
Thank you for letting me do that.
No, I'm glad to do that. In fact, here's Alan, who's a librarian in the Berkeley Public Library, who sends this email. Thanks, he says, first, for such a distinguished panel on libraries. I wanted to mention how important it is to continue to keep library buildings safe and accessible. Here in Berkeley, there's a local bond measure, FF, to bring the library branch, the Berkeley branches, excuse me, up to code, safe and accessible for library users. Just like roads and bridges built many decades ago, this work needs to be done for future generations of users. And let's go to some more of your calls. Kim, joining us. Hi. Kim, are you there?
Oh, hi.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a question for your panelists. I have many books on a variety of subjects on my bookshelves at home, and I'm interested in finding a place where I could donate them. I'm just wondering what some guidelines might be. Can I take them to my local library and see whether they're interested in any of them? What do I do?
What does she do to donate? Alice Goffier?
Well, most local libraries will accept donations that are in good shape. If they can't use them in the collection, they'll sell them in their friends' book sales. And that's a really good way to recycle the books and raise some funds for the library.
And thank you very much for the call. Actually, an email, Jane Light, you mentioned bookmobiles. This listener says, since many of our branch libraries within San Jose are currently under construction and other libraries are not easily accessible to our immediate neighborhoods, could fixed bookmobiles be located near the construction site so there's a way to pick up and drop off books from the main library without having to drive all over to open branches or the main library? One or two people could be on staff, preserving employment of staff that will eventually need to be rehired.
Well, we contemplated that idea, but realized that we no longer have any bookmobiles. A fixed bookmobile is a small temporary branch. We can't use our bond measure dollars to fund those, and we, in fact, don't have any excess staff. When we close one branch library, we move them to a new, one of the new libraries opening, and ultimately we'll need staff for six additional libraries as our system grows from 17 branches to 23. So if we had the resources for a temporary location, we would contemplate it, but it's something that the city really hasn't been able to think of.
A couple more emails, and then we'll get to some more of your calls. Hank from San Carlos writes, when I have gone into many libraries, I find that out of the 50 people in the library, 48 are on computers, and most libraries are modernized, specializing in online services as well as DVD rentals. Here's a listener from Nevada City who says, I greatly appreciate our fine local public library as well as all the staff there. My use spreads far beyond the familiar local library, however. That's because my occupation involves considerable travel, mostly road trips to less populated parts of the West. I rely heavily on public libraries to check my email and usually get email almost everywhere in all sorts of fascinating little towns. This network is vital for me. By the way, speaking of networks, really almost all libraries now have the kind of availability that ties them to other libraries to the extent that you can get interlibrary loans or you can pretty much access what other libraries have that your public library might not have. Isn't that true?
That's right. And if you have a library card in California from a public library, you can use virtually any library in the state.
And Donna is our next caller. Welcome, Donna.
Yes, thank you so much. I am really enjoying listening to this conversation. I'm with Friends of the Library in San Francisco, and I wanted to make note of a study that we have just conducted on behalf of the public libraries here in San Francisco that was aimed at looking at the sort of comprehensive value of libraries and the role and relevance in an urban setting. And we found that there were three areas in which the library was surprisingly doing a wonderful job. Not surprising that they were doing a wonderful job, but that they excelled. And those were, first of all, that there's a great economic stimulus based on the services that libraries provide in supporting small businesses, in helping people look for jobs and prepare resumes and do college counseling for high school students and that sort of thing.
Let me interrupt you. But we were talking a little bit off air with Alice Scuffy about the San Mateo Public Library, which now has not only a biotech learning center but a business center that counsels people on careers.
Yes, exactly, as does the San Francisco Public Library. And it's a place that you can go research applying for patents. You can write a business plan with the help of library staff and all sorts of things that I don't know that people are highly aware of. But
and also learn how to read. You have a literacy program that's extraordinarily
right.
effective.
Adult literacy program, Project READ, that is a tremendous economic boost in getting people into the job force and off of marginalized services and that type of thing. Another area that the libraries excel in is filling the educational gap that is being created by the defunding of school libraries and creating partnerships with teachers and with schools in which the librarians really bring the classes in, teach kids how to use the library, and have age-appropriate reference services and online homework help and things like that. And then the final area is in immigrant services, helping bring newcomers to the community, bring them farther into the city, getting them, again, off of marginalized services and that sort of thing, helping them through multilingual programs and references to learn how to navigate City Hall, look for an apartment, find all of the appropriate services that they need. And so with these sorts of things that create more of a community anchor than simply a beautiful building filled with books, which in itself is a good thing, but nonetheless, I'd love to ask the panel what they feel in terms of a national scale we can do to heighten the conversation and get these messages out to the public regarding the sort of role and economic benefit to communities of libraries.
Well, that's the big question, isn't it, in many ways, Jim Rettig? I mean, how do you get the message out? How do you market?
One of the fellow panelists earlier said that the average per capita expenditure of tax dollars for their public library is $34. Nationally, it's about $30. This is an incredible bargain if you consider what a hardback book would cost you and you have only one book, whereas for that $30, your public library will supply you with books and other information resources year-round. The tension is that, you know, these are local institutions, locally funded, and national messages may not address those particular local issues that will make advocacy a success. The best advocates, of course, are the people who use their libraries. And Martine alluded to the Spokane moms, as they're called. These are three mothers who were informed that the school librarians were going to be eliminated in their schools, and they just decided they were mad and weren't going to take it anymore. And they used the Web 2.0 tools to mobilize friends and create a movement in the state which did move the legislature for the first time to earmark funding for school libraries in the state budget.
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't conclude by adding, since we've been focusing on, and we're coming to the end of the hour, alas, on the fact that libraries have changed, they will continue to change, and, well, not only the message here, I think, is support the libraries because they're a great resource. It's implicit here. I can say that with editorial authority and confidence. But here's a listener who says they've changed in a way, just to give the full picture here, that doesn't exactly please him because he says he's a resident of the People's Republic of Berkeley and privileged to pay a very high library tax, which the Solons imposed. But he says the libraries are so noisy and says even San Francisco's beautiful new public library is too noisy. Keep your libraries quiet. Remember when we were kids, they used to say, shh, this is a library. I'd like to make a final kind of plea along those lines because I think the caller has a point. My thanks to all our guests, Martine Gomez, President of the Urban Libraries Council, Jim Reddick, President of the American Library Association, Alice Scoffier, City Librarian with the Burlingame Public Library, and Jane Light, who is Director of the San Jose Library. Thank you all, and thank you, our listeners. And thanks to our editor, senior editor Dan Zoll, and our producers Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.